It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Ever wonder why often the most interesting character in a novel or a play or a movie is the bad guy?
And if we're drawn to the dark side, to those dark characters, does that make us bad people?
That's the kind of stuff that's been in our guest's mind, so he decided to get his thoughts out in a book.
Chuck Klosterman is one of our leading pop culture critics. His latest book is called I Wear the Black Hat, Grappling with Villains Real and Imagined. And he's speaking tonight at Boswell Books in Milwaukee at 7 o'clock. Chuck, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, it's great to be here. I just arrived in Milwaukee minutes ago.
Minutes ago. Great. I hope you've had a chance to have a bathroom break and a glass of water. Well, you've got this interesting attraction thing going on with villains and villainy. How long has that been going on?
Are you talking about for me or for the world at large?
No, just for you.
Well, the way it kind of works, or the way my sort of writing career works, is I tend to do almost like, not two books at a time, but like two books in any given contract. I do a nonfiction book and a fiction book. And it seems like that over the last two or three years, I did a book called The Visible Man, which was a fictional story about essentially a situation where the protagonist of the story is a villain. I've been writing as, like, working as the ethicist for the New York Times, so I've been sort of dealing with kind of moral quandaries, and this is almost like the logical extension of that, just sort of going through the whole idea of how, particularly as people mature over time, the trajectory of their life tends to push them toward relating or understanding problematic people more than heroes. And I just kind of think it's an interesting problem.
Yeah.
Not even maybe a problem, just an interesting fact of life.
Well, you were talking about a conversation you have, this is in your book, with a friend, and you say, you make the case that for most guys out there, when they grow up, they find Darth Vader the most compelling character instead of Luke Skywalker. You want to take us through that theory?
Yeah, you know, that's a short part of the book, but it actually does sort of frame a lot of the ideas of how I work through this. I was actually talking with the editor, the guy who edited this book a couple years ago, when I had the sort of the abstract idea for what I wanted to do, but I hadn't really even started. And at the time, he had a four-year-old son, and his son had just seen Star Wars. You know, it blew his mind, as it often does for a four-year-old kid. And I was kind of gave him this theory I had, which is that there's sort of this path that particularly, I mean, I shouldn't necessarily say male members of the audience, maybe all members of the audience follow, where when they're very young, the first character in Star Wars that they associate with being the hero, who they relate to, who they identify with, is Luke Skywalker, who's this wholly good person, almost naively good. He has a very inflexible view of what is right is wrong, and what's right and what's wrong. And of course, being a kid, your parents and school and society and television tells you, you know, be a good boy, this is who you want to be like. When that person moves into high school, 12, 13, 14, maybe teenage years, you know, it tends to shift. Tends to be that the character that they like the most is Han Solo, who's fundamentally good. Like, at his core is still, on the side of good, but has sort of the trappings of a criminal, of anti-authority sort of ideas, almost as though, you know, almost like a prototypical anti-hero. But, you know, at its center, still a good person. But when you become an adult, and you're no longer looking at characters as aspirational models or things you want to become, they're more so these ideas that you're trying to see yourself in. I feel as though Darth Vader becomes the most interesting and kind of only essential character. Because when you're an adult and you're not using these figures to somehow create who you are, you actually are that person now. You're sort of trapped by your own self. You're always had this desire to sort of see yourself in other things. And I think it's kind of a natural reaction for a modern person to see themselves in a villain.
That's an interesting take. I don't know. I'd be curious to find out if other people agree with you or if that's just you. And I know that's something you grapple with. Your editor at one point, you know, doesn't he say, I think you actually wonder, Chuck, if you're evil.
Yeah, well, I mean, he also said, like, I don't know about this, but this theory, he goes, like, I think a lot of dudes kind of stop it on Solo.
Right.
And I was like, well, you know, maybe it's true. I'm not the, you know, I as a essayist and, like, a critic and stuff, I might work a little differently than other people. I think that most critics, they start with this thesis, and they try to persuade people to believe it. I don't really work that way. I'm not interested in persuading people to view the world as I do. What I kind of just do is I think, well, what's interesting to me? What are the things that for whatever reason, sort of shape my view of reality? Then I work through them, and at the end, try to draw conclusions about why I maybe unconsciously feel something, even if it has irrational underpinnings, because so much of being a person is dealing with your own irrationality.
Well, I don't think you're totally alone on this. A lot of people are drawn to villains, even though we know we should just root for the good guy. I mean, why do you think that is?
Why people are drawn to that? Well, there are many possible reasons that could be, it's very, as you've kind of mentioned in this intro, it's almost a cliche that, you know, the villains are the more interesting characters. But you know what I think it really is that I think that villains tend to feel like the more authentic characters. You know, and you see this through all idioms of art in the 18th and 19th century, saw it in literature. In the 20th century, when film really got good in the 70s, when the auteur movement was happening, that's when you saw movies like, you know, The Godfather, or that period of film, really good Jack Nicholson films, where the main character, the person we're rooting for, is troubling. Obviously, in the 70s and 80s and 90s, rock music and hip-hop sort of presented the idea that one of the characteristics of a rock star is being outside of the law. And then in the 90s, TV even caught up with this. You know, TV tends to be last when it comes to the adoption of these ideas. But with The Sopranos, really starting with that show, there was this idea that, okay, you have this person who's antisocial, but because we're seeing the show through his eyes, we still treat him in the way, you know, with the idea that he's the center of the story. He's the hero, even though he is bad. And now if you're making high-end television, whether it's, you know, Breaking Bad or Mad Men or The Wire, any of these shows, in order for it to seem real to people, the principal person has to be flawed and very often deeply flawed. And I think this is because when people see those flawed characters, they seem more authentically human. Like, it doesn't seem like they're watching something that is trying to enforce morality. It's more like a show that's saying, this is a real attempt to understand why people do the things that they do.
Well, maybe it's because as we get older, we start to know ourselves better. And when we know ourselves better, we know that there are, you know, a million different selves in there, and they're not all good and they're not all bad. And we have, you know, evil impulses and good impulses. And it's sort of this constant play of both our whole lives. And if we see that, then we see that, you know, in film, on TV, wherever you're talking about, maybe it just resonates more because we realize, hey, that's us.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think you're absolutely right in that sense. You know, I think this stretches not just to the bad things that people do, but the good things sometimes. The good things you do, and you wonder, what were my motives for doing that? Or my motives, you know, for being charitable or helping someone. Was my motive for that because I was empathetic toward this victim, this vulnerable person, that it was an altruistic act? Or did I feel a social pressure to do so? Did I want to be seen as being good? If I do something good, to be seen as such, is that actually bad?
Wow.
You know? Obviously, these are sort of like long-standing philosophical problems. Because I read about popular culture, I can kind of work through them again using things that I think probably people have a closer everyday relationship to.
Well, we're talking right now with Chuck Klosterman. He's going to be speaking tonight at Boswell Books in Milwaukee at 7 o'clock, if you'd like to catch him there. Talking about his newest book, it's called I Wear the Black Hat, Grappling with Villains Real and Imagined.
And we want to hear from you. Are you drawn to the bad guys and the things you read, the things you watch? Do you have a favorite villain? And what do you think it says about us when we like the villain so darn much? Call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're keeping on with our conversation with Chuck Klosterman, who is a pop culture critic. He's going to be in Milwaukee tonight speaking at Boswell Books at 7. And we're talking about his latest book today called I Wear the Black Hat, Grappling with Villains Real and Imagined.
And we're hoping to hear from you. Who's your favorite villain and why do you think villains are so appealing. You can call 800-642-1234 or post over at the Central Time Facebook page.
Now let's go to the phones now. We've got Jen on the line from Lodi. Hi, Jen.
Hey, how are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. I wanted to just ask really quick what the writer thought about kind of the phenomenon of Loki right now. You know, I know the Avengers is about a year out, but I mean, my gosh, the character and the actor behind the character has a huge following now. And I guess I just wonder what his thoughts are about the love of a villain over the heroes and what a handsome face behind the villain can do for that love of that villain.
Okay, thanks, Jen. Chuck?
Well, you know, the first part that she's asking about is something that isn't necessarily new, this idea that someone that is initially framed as the villain in something will emerge and the audience will almost change the context of their acts to sort of, you know, they want to like this character, so they're going to try to figure out a way to give them an ethical framework that makes it that makes sense for them to be, you know, have people root for them. But, you know, the second part she brings up, I actually kind of write about this quite a bit in the book. I talk about the Clinton Lewinsky situation. And I also talk about it in relationship to the movie Basic Instinct and Wilt Chamberlain and even slightly Ted Bundy and the sort of the weird way that attractiveness takes someone from being evil and sort of makes them tyrannically charming. I think a great present tense example right now is this controversy around Rolling Stone magazine, that they have taken the younger of the two Boston Bombers and they've put him on the cover of the magazine. He kind of looks like the drummer for the Strokes or something, you know. And there's all this sort of you know, angry response, but like, you know, well, is this glamorizing terrorism? Is it a manipulative thing? People are sort of you know, trying to almost generate ways to be outraged by this. But ultimately, what are we talking about? We're talking about the fact that a magazine made a decision that was certainly based partially by the sheer attractiveness of the villain. That I do not think that, you know, Muhammad Atta or something gets on the cover of Rolling Stone, but because this guy has almost like a Jim Morrison-like look in some weird way, it moves the goalposts and suddenly allows people to think differently about badness.
So you think Rolling Stone thought this guy is so good looking he can carry the cover?
Well, I'm sure that was part of it. I mean, I can't, you know, I'm not in the meetings with Rolling Stone. I don't work for Rolling Stone. But for someone to say like, well, they were going to put whoever this kid was on the cover, that's insane. I mean, it certainly had something to do with the fact that he looks famous. And maybe you could even argue he looks like the best possible representation of a Rolling Stone reader. The kind of person Rolling Stone wants to imagine reads their magazine is a kid who looks like this. But now this kid's also a terrorist. So, I mean, you know, that adds this element of, wow, this is, you know, this is interesting in a new way.
Well, thanks so much for the call, Jen. Appreciate that. And we move next to Sean from Milwaukee. Hi, Sean.
Hi, how are you guys?
Doing well. How about you?
I'm not too bad, hot, but otherwise okay. I just wanted to comment, especially for myself. I do definitely find myself drawn to villains in the movies, especially, I guess maybe you would call them the vigilante villain, one who is, you know, avenging a loved one or themselves or something. I spent 13 years in the Army, and I did multiple tours in Iraq and Afghanistan, and you know, I was told we were the good guys. You know, we were there to help liberate a country and to help stop oppression. But I often found myself wondering whether or not I actually was the bad guy, especially with the way that some of the people there viewed me. And I definitely think that in this day and age, the lines between what is right and what is wrong are definitely becoming much more blurred than they ever used to be.
Great. Well, thanks so much for sharing your thoughts, Sean. And maybe as a culture, we're getting used to playing more in the gray areas. What do you think about that, Chuck?
Well, the thing that he brought up first, this idea of the vigilante, that's a particularly complex situation within this conversation. You know, I have a section in this book where I sort of talk about the Bernard Goetz situation from the, you know, 1984 in New York, the subway vigilante who shot three guys in the subway. and sort of how the perception of him as a character evolved mostly through his willingness to come forward and expose who he really was. You know, in the total abstract, most intellectuals are against the idea of vigilante justice. You give them a sketch of a scenario with no details, but just an understanding of person A dealing with situation B. Suddenly then it becomes more gray, more complex. And then when the vigilante is truly exposed and we learn all these details about their life, it swings back the other way. On this book tour I've been doing, of course, many people ask about George Zimmerman, kind of in the context of Getz, you know, and the same thing. And, you know, talk about a gray case. Well, there you have it. Although he's not really a vigilante in the sense that it appears he actively pursued this kid. It wasn't really responding to violence, which in most cases, but so how we, you know, if we have a positive feeling toward the vigilante, it's because we assume they're acting as an agent for society.
So what do you think about how Sean felt? You know, he wondered if he was a good guy or a bad guy.
Well, I suppose that would be a very difficult question for anyone fighting in a war. I mean, you know, there's going to be two sides in any given war, and whoever ends up winning that war is going to be defined as the hero. You know, I'm sure there were many people fighting for Germany in World War II who assumed they were the heroes, but no one thinks that now, you know?
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much, Sean, for the call. Appreciate that. And moving next to Deborah in Waukegan, Illinois. Hey, Deborah.
Hi. Yeah, I am sick to death of the cult of the villain. I think it's awful. I mean,
what bothers you about it?
Well, I think we're headed for a cliff, basically. I mean, you know, I think as a civilization, we're in a really decadent state. And I'm not, you know, I'm not a black and white moralist, but I think the struggle to be good and do good is pretty complicated and interesting. Much more interesting to me than, you know, worshiping somebody who's doing dope or, you know, a sort of a Byronian image of a, you know, a Jim Morrison type image. I mean, it's just, I don't know. For me, we're given the gift of a life, and it truly turns my stomach that we would in any way elevate, you know, making a use of that life that is not in some way trying to do the good. And doing the good is very complicated. I mean, the man who spoke about war, God knows, it couldn't be more complicated than what the moral issues are in war. But I don't know. Maybe I'm a Virgo or something, but to me there's plenty of fascination just in the job of living an existentially moral life. And, you know, we don't have clear canons of ethics. People can hardly finish books because there's no neat outcome for a book anymore. I think it's
probably where
we read Victorian novels.
Thank you so much for that call, Deb. Appreciate that. And I guess a couple questions embedded in there, Chuck. You know, one thing is, are we in the era of the villain right now? You know, we were just talking earlier in the show about all these TV shows based on serial killers. And Obama has named his favorite character from The Wire, who is not, apparently the character is not exactly a stand-up guy either. Are we in the era of the villain? And what about Deborah's other moral questions?
Well, I mean, you know, she makes an interesting point, but you also, you know, so much of that discussion is semantic. She says the problem of being good is complicated, and that's very true. But the problem of being bad is complicated, too. The polarity can't be, well, the problem of being good is very complicated, so we shouldn't worship, you know, the villains. I don't think that's the continuum here. The fact of the matter is that as society becomes more aware of how bias impacts not just, you know, news coverage, but just our day-to-day interactions with people. You know, the guy talked about when he went to war, and he was like, I was told, you know, well, we were the good guys, you know. I think that for a long time in America, and probably in every country, that was sort of an established way to operate. How do you just tell someone that we are the good guys, and that information alone sort of decides how one behaves? But are we moving into the age of the villain? I don't think necessarily. I would like to think that we're moving into an age where consideration over what we think is good and bad is not pre-decided, that we're going to actually look at these problems and look at these reactions and look at these people and say, like, well, okay, it would be easy to draw lines up quickly, but maybe we should do it slowly.
Well, Chuck, we're about out of time, but I hope you've got time to enjoy Milwaukee, get out there, have some dinner, and enjoy your talk at Boswell's tonight.
Well, I hope people come out, and thanks for having me on.
Thanks so much for being here. That was Chuck Klosterman, a pop culture critic. His latest book, lots to chew on there, obviously. It's called I Wear the Black Hat, Grappling with Villains Real and Imagined. And you can keep that conversation going on the Central Time Facebook page and tell us what you think.
Dan from Duluth did that. He said his favorite villain is the Riddler from Batman. Thanks for that, Dan. And yeah, share your favorite villain and what you like or dislike about them. The Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up, we take a look at Detroit's budget problem and the launch of our first Hidden Wisconsin segment. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, we continue with the next installment of our six-part series on heroin from WPR News.
We'll also find out why Detroit's deep in the red and what could happen next with our fellow Midwestern city.
But first, we're launching a new segment today called Hidden Wisconsin.
The name's in honor of the book Hidden America by Jean Marie Laskus, which celebrates under-the-radar jobs that keep our country running.
So with Hidden Wisconsin, we want to hear from you. What's your job? Is it something that keeps our state humming along, that normally goes unacknowledged and needs a moment in the spotlight?
Well, joining us now, we have Jean Marie Laskus helping us kick off this segment. She's a journalist and the author of Hidden America. Jean Marie, welcome to Central Time.
Great to be here.
Well, in your book Hidden America, you celebrate professions that we don't normally think about that are still interwoven into lots of aspects of our daily lives. You hung out with cowboys and coal miners and migrant farm workers. Why do you feel it's important that we know about jobs like this and the people who do them?
Well, I think there's just an awful lot about our lives we have learned to take for granted. you know, the people who keep who make our lives really very simple, who work under the radar. I don't know, it's sort of worth taking a moment to pause and wonder, wait, how did that happen? How does this electricity even happen in my house? You know, it's because of a coal miner.
Why do you think we take those things for granted, and why are these people invisible to us?
Well, I think we've taken them for granted for several generations now. It's sort of like, you know, the sanitized way that we live, and it's great. I'm all for air conditioning, you know. But I think couple generations ago, we knew these people, you know. They were our neighbors. They were the person who brought us the milk. You knew the farmer down the road. This is the way we lived a few generations ago, but not so much anymore.
And so that's going to be the point of this segment, Hidden Wisconsin, where we talk to people in Wisconsin who do the jobs that inform our daily lives, but we don't necessarily know their faces, their names, their stories. And I wonder if you could kick us off a little bit by telling us some of the stories that you discovered while you were researching your book. Maybe tell us a little bit about the coal miners.
The coal miners, that was the first chapter that kind of brought this whole idea to light. You know, I happened to get into a coal mine one day and was stunned by the conditions under the ground there. And this guy, Smitty, one of the miners, turned to me and you know, I said to him, I don't think people have any idea what you do down here. And it was his remark. He said, yeah, I don't think that people know pretty much anything about how this whole country works. This was a really tight community of all men living in, you know, this 10 hours a day, tremendously dangerous conditions, in the dark, in a mine that was, you know, 5 feet high. No one could even stand up.
How do you even prepare yourself for something like that? It must take a special person.
It's funny. They told me that there are people, you know, apparently, right the first time you go down, whether or not you're going to be a coal miner or not. You know, you can handle it or you can't, and plenty of people absolutely can't, you know, the conditions and the, sort of the the claustrophobia and the darkness and the lack of air, you know, pretty basic matters. And you don't know going down whether or not you're going to be able to handle it. You don't know. And all the bravado in the world won't do you any good. You either can or you can't.
Now, the people we see in the media a lot are the high-profile people in the high-paying, glamorous jobs, the movie stars, the athletes, the politicians, maybe not quite so highly paid, but sort of out there and glamorous. Have we lost a sense that all jobs have a value, have a worth?
Well, I think so, and I guess that you know, so much of those kinds of jobs or people who are in the spotlight is sort of like a fantasy life, maybe. People want that, or they want to be famous or rich or, you know, all of that is, I don't know what drives that as the thing that we are most bombarded with. But I'll tell you, the people that I spent time with writing this book, that was one of the wonderful things, is like they weren't about becoming rich and famous. You know, they really weren't. They were people who were dedicated to whatever these jobs were that they had.
How did they change your life? Did you think about the world around you differently and the people that you came across?
Oh, absolutely. In many cases, yes. Probably the most striking example was the migrant workers who were, I lived in a camp up in Maine during the blueberry season, you know, just sort of picking our fruit, you know, who are the people who pick our food. And I would say of all of them, that experience changed my life daily more than any. You know, talk about something you so take for granted is how this fresh food gets to your plate, that there are people out there picking it whose fingerprints are on your fresh fruit. And living in this case, you know, in the shadows and in hiding because they were, some were legal, some were not. And that just sort of very distant society, even though it was right there, right on the other side of, you know, Maine vacation land.
You were talking to people who were underground, in some cases literally, in some cases figuratively. How did they react when someone showed this interest that gave them the opportunity to talk about what they do?
In most cases, they were either confused and like, why? I got a lot of that. Why are you interested in this? You know, but overall, I'd say people were delighted to have someone pay attention to them and to get to talk about what it is they do. They weren't used to talking about it. You know, they just daily, it was sort of like a daily life for them. But it was fascinating to me, you know, everything was, these jobs were fascinating. Who knows how these air traffic controllers, for example, you know, work all those planes around and get us on the ground safely. I mean, it was crazy.
Did you spend any time in Wisconsin when you were researching your book?
I did not. Not for any reason. I didn't want to not spend time in Wisconsin. Just I didn't have any of the chapters that had to be set, that were set there.
Well, we're going to try to extend the idea you brought up in your book to Wisconsin. Can you help us put the call out? What kind of people would you like to hear us talk about or see us talk to in Wisconsin?
Oh, boy. This is such a great... I love that you're doing this series. I would like, for me, I mean, tell me somebody who's out there doing a job that everyone is dependent on and forgets and has no idea. I mean, the mail carrier, for example, or, you know, a grade school teacher. I mean, there are an awful lot of people. It doesn't have to be blue-collar workers. This is, you know, this is across the board.
Sounds like a lot of discoveries that I'm hoping we're going to have along the way. And thank you so much for helping us launch this segment, Hidden Wisconsin. It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
Oh, my pleasure.
Jean Marie Laskus is a journalist and the author of Hidden America.
Now, here's how it works. We need to hear from you. What is your unsung profession or your nomination for somebody you know? There's a lot of ways you can get in touch with us. Here are some of them. You can email us at centraltime@wpr.org. That's centraltime, no dots there, at wpr.org. And why don't you put Hidden Wisconsin in the subject line?
You can also message us on Facebook or call the new Central Time hotline, which is toll-free, by the way. It's 855-683-5422. That's 855-683-5422. And, you know, you could be featured on our next Hidden Wisconsin segment.
Looking forward to hearing from you. Coming up, we continue our look at Wisconsin's heroin problem with the next installment in our WPR news series. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Verrett. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Today, in a continuation of our series on the growing problem of heroin in Wisconsin, we learn about a life-saving drug called naloxone, also known as Narcan.
It brings users who overdose back from the brink of death. Naloxone isn't always available, especially in rural areas, but as Kristen Durst reports, one nonprofit is working to change that.
If you're an injection drug user in South Central Wisconsin, you may know or may have heard about a guy named Jimmy.
Hello, LifePoint.
Jimmy is James Ranke. He works for the AIDS Resource Center of Wisconsin's LifePoint Needle Exchange Program. The program's mission is to prevent the spread of AIDS and hepatitis C, which can be easily transmitted by sharing needles.
Okay, so I'm over by Easttown. I stopped here for someone after Sun Prairie, and then I'm headed your way.
Ranke drives a van around all day, meeting users at their preferred location, where they swap out their dirty needles for free clean needles and other supplies. He stays busy.
Last year, we did 300,000 syringes, and it was over 2,500 stops.
Ranke also carries the drug naloxone, the generic name for Narcan. He hands it out along with a prescription and provides training.
Really, the naloxone is just a muscle shot. So you hit him in the shoulder, you hit him in the thigh, you hit him in the top of the butt, and so you can't miss.
In the event of an overdose, naloxone reverses the effects of some drugs, including heroin and oxycodone. At one of Ranke's regular stops, he provides a refill to a woman in her 40s who doesn't want to share her name. But she says she's used the drug many times on others, and recently it was used on her.
I said to my friends, I said, whoa, 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 and that's all I remember. And I guess I turned purple. So Narcan saved my life this last week, and like I said, I've had 5 saves in the last year and a half myself.
ARCW started providing naloxone to users in 2005 at its 9 locations across the state after a rise in overdoses. Scott Stokes is Prevention Services Director. He says since then, thousands of lives have been saved, but the program has its critics.
A lot of people feel like, well, if they're going to use drugs, then they need to suffer the consequences that goes along with it. My only problem with that is, you know, this isn't alcohol, where if you're drinking and driving, you lose your license. If you overdose, you die.
He says they are currently the only source in the state where users can get naloxone. He says physicians could prescribe it, but they don't. And he says without a Good Samaritan law, which would provide immunity to users, many won't call 911 because they're afraid they could face criminal charges. Also, he says there's another reason for the need for wider distribution. Many ambulances don't carry naloxone. In Wisconsin, only advanced life support level services, those that can start IVs, can legally carry the drug. Madison Fire Department paramedic Paul Poker says that's a real issue in the suburbs and rural communities with basic level EMTs.
If you have to wait 15, 20, 25 minutes to get that drug or wait for them to transport you to the hospital, the chances of long-term effects, whether it's brain damage or something like that, can go up significantly.
There is an inhaled version of Narcan that many basic level providers across the country are carrying. The State Department of Health Services, which licenses EMS services, says that would require additional training and a change in law, but that it is under consideration. In the last 5 years in Wisconsin, EMS services who've reported naloxone use to the state have used it over 15,000 times. Kristen Durst, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thanks, Kristen. Our series will continue tomorrow as we discuss how, in some communities, heroin is being considered a public health issue more than a criminal one.
And now we turn to Detroit. The Motor City has been struggling chronically with its budget deficit, which is about $20 billion. Some breaking news now. The city of Detroit is currently filing for bankruptcy. We've been looking at that story, wondering when it was going to happen, as have many around the country and, of course, in the city of Detroit. And right now we've got that news, which is that the city is, in fact, filing for bankruptcy. And we're going to welcome to the program Craig Falla. He's a talk show host at WDET and a former reporter based in Detroit. Craig, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks very much. Appreciate it.
So, Craig, what do you make of the news?
Well, it's not surprising at all. There are a couple of lawsuits that were expected to be filed on Monday by some bondholders and also pension holders. And by filing today, they can sidestep those lawsuits. All lawsuits are put on hold. So basically, this frees the city up to use some of the revenue it has coming in to keep things going while they reorganize. It had to be done at this point based on the lawsuits that were coming.
Now, this is the largest municipality in the United States to ever file for bankruptcy. What do you think this means for Detroit and how it's viewed by the rest of the country?
Well, the interesting thing so far, though, is that it hasn't stopped a lot of the investment that's been happening in the city of Detroit over the last few years. It's not as if any of this financial news in Detroit is new. I think the scope of it may have taken some people by surprise that weren't paying that close of attention, but there is still investment going on here, and a lot of people are looking at this as if the city is finally getting its act together. They're looking at this as an overall positive. I mean, it's sad that it's gotten to this point, but I think there's a lot of people that recognize that it was time to stop the denial.
Now, what about those who are worried about their pensions being cut with a bankruptcy filing?
Well, that remains to be seen what's going to happen there. I mean, pensions in Michigan law, in the Michigan Constitution, the state cannot cut pension benefits. Now, it doesn't say anything about health care benefits, so it's more than likely that a number of retirees in the city of Detroit, people that used to work for the city, are not going to have a health care plan paid for by the city any longer. Pensions are going to be more difficult. Now, one of the big questions is whether or not federal law, federal bankruptcy law, is going to trump state law on that question, and that's something that is likely going to be worked out in court.
Now, Kevin Orr was appointed by the state to oversee Detroit. What is his role in this bankruptcy procedure?
Well, he is technically called the emergency manager in the city of Detroit, the emergency financial manager in the city of Detroit. He basically takes over operation of the community. But when he was first appointed to this position, he came from the law firm of Jones Day, which is a huge bankruptcy firm. In fact, they handled a lot of the bankruptcy for the Chrysler Corporation when they went through. That got the attention of Governor Snyder, Governor Rick Snyder, when this is all going on. And Kevin Orr, who went to the University of Michigan close to the same time that the governor did, got his attention. He saw what he was able to do. And so a lot of us sort of knew when Kevin Orr was brought on that this is exactly why he was being brought here, because this is the area of expertise that he has. He knows how to negotiate with creditors. He knows how to go to court with creditors, frankly. And that's, I think, exactly what the hope was, that this could be as quick as the Chrysler deal.
So how long is the wait to find out whether this is going to go down the way Detroit hopes it will?
Well, that is unclear as well. There was, of course, the case in California, Stockton, California. It took them about a year to go through all the court proceedings to find out whether or not they were even eligible for Chapter 9 bankruptcy, because there will be a lot of creditors that challenge whether or not Detroit is even eligible to file for bankruptcy. In Detroit's situation, it won't take very long for them to demonstrate that they don't have the cash flow to pay off all their obligations. In fact, they stopped paying on some of them just a few weeks ago to pave the way for this filing today. So I don't think it's going to take very long to at least give those in charge of deciding whether or not Detroit's eligible to see that they just don't have the cash necessary to keep going the way they are.
Well, prior to this bankruptcy filing, Detroit was looking at restructuring its debt instead. What do you think tipped it over into the other side?
I honestly think that what happened was the original response to the opening offer from the city of Detroit that was frankly less than 10 cents on the dollar for some of the debt that was owed. That's what he was offering a number of the creditors. They balked at that number because that's not what they've gotten in other municipal bankruptcies, places like Alabama, of course, the county near Birmingham, Alabama. They were sort of balking at that number, but it was pretty obvious that that might be pretty close to what they get in reality. But when the pensions saw what was going on and they sued, then that forced the city to go into bankruptcy. There was not going to be any more negotiation because a lawsuit getting started on Monday of next week would have delayed things even further and caused us to go a lot longer than I think anybody wanted it to.
Now, you said before that people who are watching this, this is not a surprise, but what is the reaction on the ground in Detroit today?
You know, there's still equal parts anger and frankly, denial. You talk to a number of people that think that there's some sort of financial shell game going on here. They look at this as an opportunity for the Republican-led state legislature and the governor to come in and strip the city of its assets, sell off what they like to refer to as the city's jewels, things like the water department, Cobo Arena, which is already transferred a couple of years ago. But that's what they think is going on here. They think that there's some pot of money that's being hidden from them, when in reality, Detroit has billions of dollars of unfunded pension liabilities and an operational deficit of about $300 million. So it's not as if this could stand much longer. Depending on who you talk to, they just want to know how it's going to impact them. Now, for the average person just living in the city of Detroit, this may actually lead to some better services since it will likely free up some capital for police, garbage, things along those lines. For a retiree or a city worker, they're the ones that are likely going to feel some pain.
Now, Craig, you also said some people are just saying, hey, this is good. Detroit's getting its act together. It's cleaning up its house. And maybe this means that Detroit can look to a future that looks more like Milwaukee or Baltimore with a sort of a renaissance in terms of the aftermath of failing industries and shrinking populations. Within about 30 seconds, what do you think? Is that going to be the case with Detroit?
Well, like you said, it's already happening. We're seeing a lot of investment here in the city of Detroit, and a lot of people are wondering whether or not the financial situation was going to be an impediment or something that spurred it. And the investment has not stopped, even with all of this news. So I think it's there. They've got a lot of work to do. There's no question about it. There's a ton of work to do in Detroit.
Well, Craig, thank you so much for making the time to talk today. We appreciate it.
Sure.
Craig Folley is our guest now. He was a talk show host and a former reporter based in Detroit.